Side 11. The Sapphire Rose by David Eddings. Continuing on page 368. We've got what appears to be a deserted city out there, but there are sure to be patrols of Otha's elite guards. We might possibly be able to avoid them, but it wouldn't be a good idea to pin too many hopes on that. I just wish I knew a little bit more about the city itself. And about how good Otha's elite guards are, Tinian added. They're adequate soldiers, Bavier supplied. Would they be a match for church knights? Tinian asked. No, but then who is? Bavier said it with no trace of immodesty. They're probably about on a par with the soldiers in King Worgen's army. You've been here before, Sophrania, Sparhawk said. Just exactly where are the palace and the temple located?
They're the same building, actually, she replied, and they're in the exact center of the city.
Then it wouldn't really matter which gate we used, would it? She shook her head. Isn't it rather odd for a palace and a temple to be under the same roof? Curic asked.
Zamoks are odd people, she told him. Actually, there is some degree of separation, but you have to go through the palace to reach the temple. The temple itself doesn't have any outside entrances.
Then all we have to do is ride to the palace and knock on the door, Galton said.
No, Curic disagreed firmly. We walk to the palace and we'll talk about knocking when we get there.
Walk?
Galton sounded injured. Horses make too much noise on paved streets, and they're a little hard to hide when you need to take cover.
Walking any distance in full armor isn't much fun, Curic.
You wanted to be a knight.
As I remember it, you and Sparhawk even volunteered.
Could you sort of whistle up that invisibility spell Sparhawk told us about? Galton asked Sophrania. The one Flute used to play on her pipes?
She shook her head.
Why not?
She hummed a short musical phrase. Do you recognize that melody? She asked him.
He frowned.
I can't say that I do.
That was the traditional Pandion hymn. I'm sure you're familiar with it. Does that answer your question?
Oh. Music isn't one of your strong points, I see.
What would happen if you tried it and hit the wrong notes?
Talon asked curiously. She shuddered.
Please, don't ask.
We skulk then, Galton said. So let's get to skulking.
Just as soon as it gets dark, Sparhawk said.
It was just a mile or more across a flat, dusty plain to the grim walls of Zamok, and the armored knights were all sweating profusely by the time they reached the west gate.
Muggy, Galton said quietly, wiping his streaming face. Isn't there anything normal about Zamok? It shouldn't be this sticky at this time of year.
There's definitely some unusual weather coming in, Curic agreed.
The distant rumble of thunder and the pale flickers of lightning illuminating the cloud banks lying to the east confirmed their observations.
Maybe we could appeal to Otha for shelter from the storm, Tinian said.
What are the Zamok views on hospitality?
Undependable,
Sophrania replied. We'll want to be as quiet as we can once we're in the city, Sparhawk cautioned.
Sophrania lifted her head and looked off to the east, her pale face scarcely visible in the sultry darkness.
Let's wait a bit, she suggested. That storm's moving this way. Thunder would cover a great deal of incidental clanking.
They waited, leaning against the basalt walls of the city as the crack and tearing roar of the thunder marched inexorably toward them.
That should cover any noise we make, Sparhawk said after about 10 minutes. Let's get inside before the rain comes.
The gate itself was made of crudely squared-off logs bound with iron, and it stood slightly ajar. Sparhawk and his companions drew their weapons and slipped through one by one. There was a strange smell to the city, an odor that seemed to have no counterpart in any place Sparhawk had ever visited. It was an odor neither fair nor foul, but one that was more than anything peculiarly alien. There were no torches to provide illumination, of course, and they were forced to rely upon the intermittent flickers of lightning staining the purple cloud banks rolling in from the east.
The streets revealed by those flashes were narrow, and their paving stones had been worn smooth by centuries of shuffling feet. The houses were tall and narrow, and their windows were small and, for the most part, barred. The perpetual dust storms that scoured the city had rubbed the stones of the houses quite smooth. The same gritty dust had gathered in corners and along the doorsills of the houses to give the city, which could not have been deserted for much more than a few months, the air of a ruin abandoned for eons. Talon slipped up behind Sparhawk and rapped on his armor.
"Don't do that, Talon!"
"It got your attention, didn't it? I've got an idea. Are you going to argue with me about it?"
"I don't think so. What was it you wanted to argue about?"
"I have certain talents that are rather unique in this group, you know."
"I doubt that you'll find very many purses to slit open, Talon. I don't see all that many people about."
"Ha," Talon said flatly. "Ha, ha, ha. Now that you're past that, are you ready to listen?"
"I'm sorry. Go ahead."
"None of the rest of you could really sneak through a graveyard without waking up half the occupants, right?"
"I wouldn't go quite that far."
"I would. I'll go on ahead, not too far, but just far enough. I'll be able to come back and tell you about anybody coming, or hiding in ambush."
Sparhawk didn't wait this time. He made a grab for the boy, but Talon slipped out of his reach quite easily.
"Don't do that, Sparhawk. You just make yourself look foolish."
He ran off a few feet, then stopped and slid his hand down into one boot. From its place of concealment, he drew a long, needle-pointed dirk. Then he vanished up the dark, narrow street. Sparhawk swore. "What's the matter?" Curic asked from not far behind him. "Talon just ran off."
"He did what?"
"He says he's going to scout on ahead. I tried to stop him, but I couldn't catch him." From somewhere off in the maze of twisting streets there came a deep, mindless kind of howling.
"What's that?"
Xavier asked, taking a tighter grip on his long-handled Lochaber axe.
"The wind, maybe?" Tinian replied without much conviction.
"The wind isn't blowing."
"I know, but I think I prefer to believe that's what's causing the noise anyway. I don't like the alternatives."
They moved on, staying close to the sides of the houses and freezing involuntarily in their tracks with each flash of lightning and crack of thunder. Talon came back, running on silent feet.
"There's a patrol coming," he said, staying just back out of reach. "Would you believe they're carrying torches? They're not trying to find anybody, they're trying to make sure they don't."
"How many?" Euleth asked.
"A dozen or so."
"Hardly enough to worry about, then."
"Why not just cut over to the next street through this alley? Then you won't even have to look at them, much less worry."
The boy darted into an alleyway and disappeared again.
"The next time we choose a leader, I think I'll vote for him," Euleth murmured.
They moved on through the narrow, twisting streets. With Talon probing ahead of them, they were easily able to avoid the sporadic Zamok patrols. As they worked their way nearer to the center of the city, however, they reached a quarter where the houses were more imposing and the streets were wider. The next time Talon came back, a momentary flash of ghostly lightning revealed a disgusted expression on his face.
"There's another patrol just ahead," he reported. "The only trouble is that they're not patrolling. It looks as if they broke into a wine shop. They're sitting in the middle of the street drinking."
Euleth shrugged.
"We'll just slip around them through the alleys again."
"We can't," Talon said. "There aren't any alleys leading off this street. I haven't found any way to get around them, and we have to use this street. As nearly as I can tell, it's the only one in the district that leads to the palace. This town doesn't make any sense at all. None of the streets go where they're supposed to."
"How many of these revelers do we have to contend with?" Xavier asked him.
5 or 6.
"And they have torches?"
Talon nodded.
"They're just around this next turn in the street."
"With the torches flaring right in their eyes, they won't be able to see in the dark very well."
Xavier flexed his arm, swinging his axe suggestively.
"What do you think?" Calton asked Sparhawk.
"We might as well," Sparhawk said. "It doesn't sound as if they'll volunteer to get out of our way." It was more in the nature of simple murder than a fight. The carouse of the Zamok patrol had advanced to the point where they were aggressively inattentive. The church knights simply walked up to them and cut them down. One of them cried out briefly, but his surprised shout was lost in a tearing crash of thunder.
Without a word, the knights dragged the inert bodies to nearby doorways and concealed them. Then, they gathered protectively around Sophronia and continued along that wide, lightning-illuminated street toward the sea of smoky torches that appeared to be encircling Otha's palace. Once again they heard that howling sound, a sound devoid of any semblance of humanity. Talon returned, making no effort to evade them this time. "The palace isn't far ahead," he said, speaking quietly despite the now almost continuous thunder. "There are guards out front. They're wearing armor of some kind. It's got all kinds of steel points sticking out of it. They look like hedgehogs."
"How many?" Calton asked.
"More than I had time to count. Do you hear that wailing noise?"
"I've been trying not to."
"I think you'd better get used to it. The guards are the ones making it."
Otha's palace was larger than the basilica in Kyrillos, but it had no architectural grace. Otha had begun his life as a goatherd, and the principle that seemed to guide his sense of taste could best be summed up in the single word, large. So far as Otha was concerned, bigger was better. His palace had been constructed of fractured, rusty black basalt rock. Because of its flat sides, basalt is easy for masons to work, but it offers little in the way of beauty. It lends itself to massive construction and not much else. The palace reared like a mountain in the center of Zamok. There were towers, of course, palaces always have towers, but the rough black spires clawing at the air above the main building had no grace, no balance, and in most cases no evident purpose. Many of them had been started centuries before and then never finished. They jutted into the air, half-completed, and surrounded by the rotting remains of crude scaffolding. The palace did not exude so much a sense of evil as it did of madness, of a kind of frenzied but purposeless effort. Beyond the palace, Sparhawk could see the swelling dome of the Temple of Azash, a perfect rusty black hemisphere constructed of huge, rigidly symmetrical hexagonal blocks of basalt that gave it the appearance of the nest of some enormous insect or a vast scabbed-over wound. The area surrounding the palace and the adjoining temple was a kind of paved dead zone, where there were no buildings or trees or monuments. It was simply a flat place extending out perhaps 200 yards from the walls. It was lighted on this darkest of nights by thousands of torches thrust at random into the cracks between the flagstones to form what almost appeared to be a knee-high field of tossing fire. The broad avenue that the knights were following appeared to continue directly across the fiery plaza to the main portal of the House of Otha, where it entered with undiminished breadth through the widest and highest pair of arched doors Sparhawk had ever seen. Those doors stood ominously open. The guards stood in the space between the walls and that broad grain field of torches. They were armored, but their armor was more fantastic than any Sparhawk had ever seen. Their helmets had been wrought into the shape of skulls, and they were surmounted by branching steel antlers. The various joints, shoulder and elbow, hip and knee, were decorated with long spikes and flaring protrusions. Their forearms were studded with hooks, and the weapons they grasped were not so much weapons of death, but of pain, with sawtooth edges and razor-like barbs. Their shields were large and hideously painted. Sir Tinian was Daeirin, and Daeirins from time immemorial have been the world's experts on armor. "Now that's the most idiotic display of pure childishness I've ever seen in my life," he said contemptuously to the others during a momentary lull in the thunder.
"Oh,"
Calton said.
"Their armor's almost useless. Good armor is supposed to protect the man wearing it, but give him a certain freedom of movement. There's not much point in turning yourself into a turtle."
"It looks sort of intimidating, though."
"That's all it really is. Something worn for its appearance. All those spikes and hooks are useless. And worse yet, they'll just guide an opponent's weapon to vulnerable points. What were their armorers thinking of?"
"It's a legacy from the last war," Sophronia explained. "The Zamoks were overwhelmed by the appearance of the church knights. They didn't understand the actual purpose of armor, only its frightening appearance. So their armorers concentrated on appearance rather than utility. Zamoks don't wear armor to protect themselves. They wear it to frighten their opponents."
"I'm not the least bit frightened, little mother," Tinian said gaily. "This is going to be almost too easy."
Then, at some signal only Otha's hideously garbed warriors could perceive, they all broke into that mindless wailing, a kind of gibbering howl devoid of any meaning.
Is that supposed to be some kind of war cry? Bayret asked nervously.
It's about the best they can manage, Sophronia told him.
Zamok culture is basically Styrek, and Styreks don't know anything about war. Elines shout when they go to war. Those guards are just trying to imitate the sound.
Why don't you take out the Belium and erase them, Sparhawk?
Talon suggested.
No, Sophronia said sharply. The troll gods are confined now. Let's not turn them loose again until we're in the presence of Azash. There's not too much point in unleashing Belium on common soldiers and risking what we came here to do.
She has a point, Tinian conceded.
They aren't moving, Ulith said, looking at the guards. I'm sure they can see us, but they aren't making any effort to form up and protect that doorway. If we can smash through to the door, go inside and close it behind us, we won't have to worry about them anymore.
Now that may just be the most inept plan I've ever heard, Colton scoffed.
Can you think of a better one?
No, as a matter of fact, I can't.
Well, then?
The knights formed up in their customary wedge formation and strode rapidly toward the gaping portal of Otha's palace. As they approached through that fiery field, an oddly familiar reek came momentarily to Sparhawk's nostrils. As quickly as it had begun, the meaningless howling broke off, and the guards in their skull-faced armor stood motionless. They did not brandish their weapons or even attempt to gather more force before the portal. They simply stood. Again there came that penetrating reek, but it was quickly swept away by a sudden wind. The lightning redoubled its fury and began to blast great chunks from nearby buildings with deafening crashes. The air about them seemed suddenly tinglingly alive.
Down! Kurek barked sharply. Everybody, get down on the ground!
They did not understand, but they all immediately obeyed, diving for the ground with a great clattering of their armor. The reason for Kurek's alarmed shout became immediately apparent. Two of the grotesquely armored guards to the left of the massive doors were suddenly engulfed in a brilliant ball of bluish fire, and were quite literally blasted to pieces. Their fellows did not move or even turn to look as scorched bits and pieces of armor showered upon them.
"It's the armor!" Kurek shouted over the crashing thunder. "Steel attracts lightning! Stay down!"
The lightning continued to blast down into the metal-clad ranks of the skull-faced guardsmen, and the smell of burning flesh and hair gusted back across the broad plaza as the sudden wind swirled and rebounded from the high basalt walls of the palace.
"They're not even moving!" Colton exclaimed.
"Nobody's that disciplined!"
Then, as the storm continued its ponderous march, the sudden flurry of lightning moved on to shatter deserted houses instead of steel-clad men.
"Is it all right now?"
Sparhawk demanded of his squire.
"I don't know for certain," Kurek told him. "If you start to feel any kind of tingling, get down immediately."
They rose warily to their feet.
"Was that Azash?" Tinian asked Sophronia.
"I don't think so. If Azash had thrown the lightning, I don't think he'd have missed us. It might have been Otha, though. Until we get to the temple, we're more likely to encounter Otha's work than anything conjured up by Azash."
"Otha? Is he really that skilled?"
"Skilled probably isn't the right word," she replied. "Otha has great power, but he's clumsy. He's too lazy to practice."
They continued their menacing advance, but the men awaiting them in that grotesque armor still made no move either to attack or even reinforce those of their number barring the door. When Sparhawk reached the first of the guards, he raised his sword, and the previously motionless man howled at him and clumsily raised a broad-bladed axe embellished with useless spikes and barbs. Sparhawk slapped the axe aside and struck with his sword. The dreadful-looking armor was even less useful than Tinian had suggested. It was scarcely thicker than paper, and Sparhawk's sword stroke slashed down into the guard's body as if it had met no resistance whatsoever. Even had he struck at a totally unprotected man, his sword should not have cut so deeply into the body. Then the man he had just slaughtered collapsed, and his gashed armor gaped open. Sparhawk recoiled in sudden revulsion. The body inside the armor had not been the body of a living man. It appeared to be no more than blackened, slimy bones with a few shreds of rotting flesh clinging to them. A dreadful stink suddenly boiled out of the armor.
"They aren't alive!" Ulith roared. "There's nothing in the armor but bones and rotting guts!"
Sickened, gagging with nausea, the knights fought on, hacking their way through their already dead enemies.
Stop! Sifrenia cried sharply. But, Calton started to object, take one step backward, all of you. They grudgingly stepped back a pace, and the outrageously armored cadavers menacing them returned to immobility. Once again at that unseen and unheard signal, they gave vent to that emotionless howl.
What's going on? Euleth demanded. Why aren't they attacking?
Because they're dead, Euleth, Sifrenia said. Euleth pointed at a crumpled form with his axe.
Dead or not, this one still tried to stick his spear into me.
That's because you came to within reach of his weapon. Look at them. They're standing all around us, and they aren't making any move to assist their companions. Get me a torch, Talon.
The boy wrested a torch from between two flagstones and handed it to her. She raised it and peered at the paving beneath their feet.
That's frightening, she said with a shudder.
We will protect you, Lady Sifrenia, Bavier assured her. You have nothing to fear.
There's nothing for any of us to fear, dear Bavier. What's truly frightening is the fact that Otha probably has more power at his command than any living human, but he's so stupid that he doesn't even know how to use it. We've spent centuries fearing an absolute imbecile.
Raising the dead is fairly impressive, Sifrenia, Sparhawk suggested.
Any steric child can galvanize a corpse, but Otha doesn't even know what to do with them once he raises them. Each one of his dead guardians is standing on a flagstone, and that flagstone is all it's protecting.
Are you sure?
Test it and see for yourself.
Sparhawk raised his shield and advanced on one of the stinking guards. As soon as his foot touched the flagstone, the skull-faced thing swung jerkily at him with a jagged-bladed axe. He easily deflected the stroke and stepped back. The guard returned to its former position and stood motionless as a statue. The vast circle of guards ringing the palace and the temple howled their empty howl again. Then, to Sparhawk's horror, Sifrenia gathered her white robe about her and quite calmly began to thread her way through the ranks of the stinking dead. She stopped and glanced back at them.
Oh, do come along now. Let's get inside before the rain starts. Just don't step on any of their flagstones, that's all.
It was eerie to step around those savagely threatening figures with their foul reek and their skull-like faces in the ghastly light of the dancing lightning, but no more dangerous, in fact, than avoiding nettles on a forest trail. When they had passed the last of the dead sentries, Talon stopped and squinted along a diagonal rank of those guardians.
"Revered teacher,"
he said quietly to Bayret.
"Yes, Talon." "Why don't you push this one over?"
Talon pointed at the back of one of the armored figures.
"Sort of off to the side."
"Why?" Talon grinned a wicked kind of grin.
"Just give it a shove, Bayret. You'll see."
Bayret looked a bit puzzled, but he reached out with his axe and gave the rigid corpse a good shove. The armored figure fell, crashing into another. The second corpse promptly beheaded the first, staggering back as it did so, and it was immediately chopped down by a third. The chaos spread rapidly, and a sizable number of the intimidating dead were dismembered by their fellows in a mindless display of unthinking savagery.
"That's a very good boy you have there, Curic," Euleth said.
"We have some hopes for him," Curic said modestly. They turned toward the portal and then stopped. Hanging in midair, in the very center of the dark doorway, was a misty face, engraved upon the emptiness with sickly green flame. The face was grotesquely misshapen, a thing of towering, implacable evil. And it was familiar. Sparhawk had seen it before.
"Azash!" Sifrenia hissed. "Stay back, all of you!"
They stared at the ghastly apparition.
"Is that really him?"
Tinian asked in an awed voice.
"An image of him," Sifrenia replied. "It's more of Otha's work."
"Is it dangerous?"
Calton asked her.
"To step into the doorway means death, and worse than death."
"Are there any other ways to get in?" Calton asked her, eyeing the glowing apparition fearfully.
"I'm sure there are, but I doubt if we'd ever be able to find them."
Sparhawk sighed. He had decided a long time ago that he would do this when the time came. He regretted the argument it was going to cause more than the act itself. He detached Belliom's steel mesh pouch from his belt.
All right, he said to his friends. You'd better get started. I can't give you any guarantees about how much time I'll be able to give you, but I'll hold off for as long as I can. What are you talking about? Carlton asked suspiciously. This is as close to a zash as we're going to get, I'm afraid. We all know what has to be done, and it's only going to take one of us to do it. If any of you ever makes it back to Simera, tell Alana that I wished that this had turned out differently. Sifrenia, is this close enough? Will Azash be destroyed? Her eyes were full of tears, but she nodded. Let's not get sentimental about this, Sparhawk said brusquely. We don't have the time. I'm honored to have known you. All of you. Now get out of here, that's an order. He had to get them moving before they began making foolishly noble decisions. Go! He roared at them. And watch how you step around those guards. They were moving now. Military men always respond to commands, if the commands are shouted. They were moving, and that was all that was important. The whole gesture was probably futile anyway. If what Sifrenia had said was true, they would need at least a day to get beyond the area that would be totally destroyed when he smashed the Belium, and there was little hope that he could remain undiscovered for that long. He had to at least try to give them that one slim chance, though. Perhaps no one would come out of the palace, and none of the patrols roving the streets would chance to see him. It was nice to think so, anyway. He did not want to watch them go. It would be better that way. There were things to be done, anyway, things far more important than standing forlornly like a child who has misbehaved and is being left behind while the rest of the family goes off to the fair. He looked first to the right, and then to the left. If Sifrenia had been right, and if this was the only way into Otha's palace, it would be better to go off some distance from the gaping portal and its glowing apparition. That way, all he would need to concern himself about would be those patrols. Anyone, or anything, emerging from the palace wouldn't immediately see him. Left or right? He shrugged. What difference did it make? Perhaps it might be better to slip around the outer perimeter of the palace and to wait against the wall of the temple itself. He'd be closer to Azash that way, and the Elder God would be closer to the center of that absolute obliteration. He half-turned and saw them. They were standing beyond the ranks of the threatening dead. Their faces were resolute. "What are you doing?" he called to them. "I told you to get out of here." We decided to wait for you, Carlton called back. Sparhawk took a threatening step toward them. Don't be foolish, Sparhawk, Kurek said. You can't afford to risk trying to sidestep your way through those dead men. If you make a single misstep, one of them will brain you from behind, and then Azash will get Belium. Did we really come all this way just for that? Chapter 27 Sparhawk swore. Why couldn't they just do as they had been told? Then he sighed. He should have known they wouldn't obey. There was no help for it now, and no point in berating them about it. He pulled off his gauntlet to take his water bottle from his belt, and his ring flashed blood red in the torchlight. He worked the stopper out of the bottle and drank. The ring flashed in his eyes again. He lowered the bottle, looking thoughtfully at the ring. Sifrenia, he said almost absently, I need you. She was at his side in a few moments. The Seeker was Azash, wasn't it?
That's an oversimplification, Sparhawk.
You know what I mean. When we were at King Sarek's grave in Pelosia, Azash spoke to you through the Seeker, but he ran away when I started after him with Aldrea's spear.
Yes?
And I used the spear to chase away that thing that came out of the mound in Lamarkand, and I killed Gwerig with it.
Yes.
But it wasn't really the spear, was it? It isn't really all that much of a weapon, after all. It was the rings, wasn't it?
I don't see where you're going with this, Sparhawk.
Neither do I, exactly. He pulled off his other gauntlet and held his hands out looking at the rings. They have a certain amount of power themselves, don't they? I think maybe I've been getting a little overwhelmed by the fact that they're the keys to Belium. Beliom's got so much power that I've been overlooking things that can be done with just the rings alone. Aldrea's spear didn't really have anything to do with it. Which is a good thing, actually, since it's standing in a corner in Alana's apartment back in Simara. Any weapon would have served just as well, wouldn't it? As long as the rings were touching it, yes. Please, Sparhawk, just get to the point. Your Aline logic is tedious. It helps me to think. I could clear that image out of the doorway with Beliom, but that would turn the troll gods loose, and they'd be trying to stab me in the back every time I turned around. But the troll gods have no connection with the rings. I can use the rings without waking Gnomb and his friends. What would happen if I took my sword in both hands and touched it to that face hanging in the doorway? She stared at him. We aren't really talking about Azash here. We're dealing with Otha. I may not be the greatest magician in the world, but I really don't have to be as long as I have the rings. I think they may just be more than a match for Otha, wouldn't you say?
I can't tell you, Sparhawk. Her tone was subdued. I don't know.
Why don't we try it and find out? He turned and looked back across the ranks of the reeking dead. All right, he called to his friends. Come back here. We've got something to do. They slipped warily past the armored cadavers and gathered around Sparhawk and his tutor. I'm going to try something that might not work, he told them. And if it doesn't, you're going to have to deal with Beliom. He took the steel mesh pouch from his belt. If what I try fails, spill Beliom out on the flagstones and smash it with a sword or an axe. He gave the pouch to Curic, handed Colton his shield, and drew his sword. He gripped its hilt in both hands and strode back to the vast doorway with the glowing apparition hanging in its center. He lifted his sword. Wish me luck, he said. Anything else would have smacked of bombast. He straightened his arms, leveling his sword at the image etched in green fire before him. He steeled himself, and deliberately stepped forward to bring his sword point into contact with the burning enchantment. The results were satisfyingly spectacular. The touch of the sword point exploded the burning image, showering Sparhawk with a waterfall of multicolored sparks, and the detonation probably shattered every window for miles in any direction. Sparhawk and all of his friends were hurled to the ground, and the armored corpses still standing guard before the palace were felled like new-mown wheat. Sparhawk shook his head to clear away the ringing in his ears, and struggled to get back on his feet again as he stared at the portal. One of the vast doors had been split down the middle, and the other hung precariously from a single hinge. The apparition was gone, and in its place hung a few tatters of wispy smoke. From deep inside the palace there came a prolonged, bat-like screech of agony. Is everybody all right? Sparhawk shouted, looking at his friends. They were struggling to their feet, their eyes slightly unfocused. Noisy, was all Yuleth said. Who's making all that noise inside? Colton asked. Otha, I'd imagine, Sparhawk replied. Having one of your spells shattered gives you quite a turn. He retrieved his gauntlets and the steel mesh pouch. Talon! Curic shouted. No! But the boy had already walked directly into the open doorway. There doesn't seem to be anything here, Father, he reported, walking farther inside and then back out again. Since I didn't vanish in a puff of smoke, I think we can say that it's safe. Curic started to move toward the boy, his hands outstretched hungrily. Then he thought better of it and stopped, muttering curses.
Let's go inside, Sifrania said. I'm sure every patrol in the city heard that blast. We can hope that they thought it was only thunder, but some of them are bound to come to investigate.
Sparhawk picked up the pouch and tucked it back under his belt. We'll want to get out of sight once we're inside. Which way should we go?
There to the left once we're through the doorway. The passages on that side lead to the kitchens and the storerooms.
All right, then. Let's go. That alien smell Sparhawk had noticed when they had first entered the city was stronger here in the dark corridors of the palace. The knights moved cautiously, listening to the echoes of the shouts of the elite guards. The palace was in turmoil, and even in a place as vast as this there were bound to be encounters.
In most cases, Sparhawk and his friends evaded these by simply stepping into the dark chambers that lined the corridors. Sometimes, however, that was not possible. But the knights of the church were far more skilled at close combat than the Zamoks, and what noise the encounters produced was lost in the shouting that echoed through the corridors. They pressed on, their weapons at the ready. It was nearly an hour later when they entered a large pastry kitchen, where the banked fires provided a certain amount of light. They stopped there and closed and barred the doors. "I'm all turned around," Calton confessed, stealing a small cake. "Which way do we go?"
"Through that door, I think," Sophronia replied. "The kitchen's all open into a corridor that leads to the throne room."
"Otha eats in his throne room?" Xavier asked in some surprise.
"Otha doesn't move around very much," she answered. "He can't walk anymore."
"What happened to him to cripple him?"
"His appetite. Otha eats almost constantly, and he's never been fond of exercise. His legs are too weak to carry him anymore."
"How many doors into the throne room?" Euloth asked her.
She thought a moment, remembering. 4, I think. The one from the kitchen's here, another coming in from the main palace, and the one leading to Otha's private quarters.
And the last?
The last entrance doesn't have a door. It's the opening that leads into the maze.
Our first move should be to block those, then. We'll want some privacy when we talk with Otha. And anybody else who happens to be there, Calton added. I wonder if Martell's managed to get here yet. He took another cake. There's one way to find out, Tinian said.
In a moment, Sparhawk said. What's this maze you mentioned, Sophronia?
It's the route to the temple. There was a time when people were fascinated by labyrinths. It's very complicated and very dangerous.
Is that the only way to get to the temple?
She nodded.
The worshippers walk through the throne room to get to the temple?
Ordinary worshippers don't go into the temple, Sparhawk. Only priests and sacrifices.
We should probably rush the throne room, then.
We'll bar the doors, deal with whatever guards may be in there, and then take Otha prisoner. If we put a knife to his throat, I don't think any of his soldiers will interfere with us.
Otha's a magician, Sparhawk, Tinian reminded him. Taking him prisoner might not be as easy as it sounds.
Otha's no particular danger at the moment, Sophronia disagreed. We've all had spells come apart on us before. It takes a while to recover from that.
Are we ready, then? Sparhawk asked tensely. They nodded, and he led them through the doorway.
The corridor leading from the kitchens to Otha's throne room was narrow and not very long. Its far end was illuminated by ruddy torchlight. As they neared that light, Talon slipped on ahead, his soft shod feet making no sound on the flagstone floor. He returned in a few moments.
"They're all there," he whispered in a voice tight with excitement. "Aeneas, Martell, and the rest. It looks as if they just got here. They're still wearing traveler's cloaks."
"How many guards in the room?" Curic asked him.
"Not too many. 20 or so at the most."
"The rest of them are probably out in the halls looking for us."
"Can you describe the room?" Tinian asked. "And the places where the guards are standing?"
Talon nodded.
"This corridor opens out not far from the throne itself. You'll be able to pick Otha out of the rest almost immediately. He looks a lot like a garden slug. Martell and the others are gathered around him. There are 2 guards at each of the doors, except for the archway right behind the throne. Nobody's guarding that one. The rest of the guards are scattered along the walls. They're wearing mail and swords, and each one of them is holding a long spear. There are 12 or so burly fellows in loincloths squatting near the throne. They don't have any weapons." "Otha's bearers," Sophronia explained.
"You were right," Talon told her. "There are 4 doors. This one just ahead of us, another over on the far side of the room, the archway, and a bigger one down at the end of the room."
"The door that leads out into the rest of the palace," Sophronia said.
"That's the important one, then," Sparhawk decided. "There's nobody in these kitchens but a few cooks, I'd imagine, and not very many people in Otha's bedroom. But there'll be soldiers on the other side of that main door. How far is it from this door to that one?"
"About 200 feet, the boy said.
"Who feels like running?"
Sparhawk looked around at his friends. "What do you say, Tinian?"
Euloth asked.
"How fast can you cover 200 feet?
"As fast as you can, my friend."
"We'll take care of it, Sparhawk,"
Ulith said.
Don't forget that you promised to let me have Addis, Calton reminded his friend. I'll try to save him for you. They moved purposefully ahead toward the torchlit doorway. They paused just back from it. Then they rushed through. Ulith and Tinian sprinted toward the main door. There were cries of shock and alarm as the knights burst into the throne room. Otha's soldiers shouted conflicting orders to each other, but one officer overrode them all with the hoarse bellow, "Protect the Emperor!"
The mailed guards lining the walls deserted their comrades at the doors and rushed to form a protective ring around the throne with their spears. Calton and Bavier had almost negligently cut down the two guards at the entrance to the corridor leading back into the kitchens, and then Ulith and Tinian reached the main door, where the two guards were desperately trying to open it to cry for help. Both men fell in the first flurry of strokes, and then Ulith set his massive back against the door and braced himself, while Tinian pawed behind the nearby draperies, looking for the bar to lock the door. Beirut dashed through the doorway beside Sparhawk, leaped over the still weakly moving guards on the floor, and ran toward the door on the opposite side of the room with his axe raised. Even though he was encumbered by his armor, he ran like a deer across the polished floor of the throne room, and fell upon the two men guarding the door that led back to Otha's bedchamber. He brushed aside their spears and disposed of them with two powerful axe blows. Sparhawk heard the solid metallic clank behind him as Calton slammed the heavy iron bar into place. There was a pounding on the outside of the door Ulith was holding closed, and then Tinian found the iron bar and slid it into place. Beirut barred his door as well.
Very workmanlike, Kurik approved. We still can't get to Otha, though.
Sparhawk looked at the ring of spears around the throne, and then at Otha himself.
As Talon had said, the man who had terrified the West for the past 5 centuries looked much like a common slug. He was pallid white and totally hairless. His face was grossly bloated and so shiny with sweat as to look almost as if it were covered with slime. His paunch was enormous, and it protruded so far in front of him that it gave his arms the appearance of being stunted. He was incredibly dirty, and priceless rings decorated his greasy hands. He half lay on his throne as if something had hurled him back. His eyes were glazed and his limbs and body were twitching convulsively. He had obviously still not recovered from the shock of the breaking of his spell. Sparhawk drew in a deep breath to steady himself, looking around as he did so. The room itself was decorated with the ransom of kings. The walls were covered with hammered gold, and the columns were sheathed in mother-of-pearl. The floor was of polished black onyx, and the draperies flanking each door were of blood-red velvet. Torches protruded from the walls at intervals, and very large iron braziers stood one on each side of Otha's throne. And then, at last, Sparhawk looked at Martell.
"Ah, Sparhawk," the white-haired man drawled urbanely. "So good of you to drop by. We've been expecting you."
The words seemed almost casual, but there was the faintest hint of an edge to Martell's voice. He had not expected them to arrive so soon, and he had certainly not expected their sudden rush. He stood with Aeneas, Arissa, and Lycaeus within the safety of the Ring of Spears, while Addis encouraged the spearmen with kicks and curses.
"We were in the neighborhood, anyway."
Sparhawk shrugged.
"How have you been, old boy? You look a bit travel-worn. Was it a difficult journey?"
"Nothing unbearable."
Martell inclined his head toward Sophronia.
"Little mother," he said, sounding once again oddly regretful.
Sophronia sighed but said nothing.
"I see we're all here," Sparhawk continued. "I do so enjoy these little get-togethers, don't you? They give us the chance to reminisce."
He looked at Aeneas, whose subordinate position to Martell was now clearly evident.
"You should have stayed in Kyrelos, Your Grace," he said. "You missed all the excitement of the election. Would you believe that the Hierocracy actually put Dolmant on the Archprelate's throne?"
A look of sudden anguish crossed the face of the Primate of Cimera.
"Dolmant!"
he choked in a stricken voice. In later years, Sparhawk was to conclude that his revenge upon the Primate had been totally complete in that instant. The pain his simple statement had caused his enemy
was beyond his ability to comprehend it. The life of the primate of Cimera crumbled and turned to ashes in that single moment. "Astonishing, isn't it?" Sparhawk continued relentlessly. "Absolutely the last man anyone would have expected. Many in Kyrelos feel that the hand of God was involved. My wife, the Queen of Elenia. You remember her, don't you? Blonde girl, rather pretty, the one you poisoned. Made a speech to the patriarchs just as they were beginning their deliberations. It was she who suggested him. She was amazingly eloquent, but it's generally believed that her speech was inspired by God himself, particularly in view of the fact that Dolmant was elected unanimously."
"That's impossible!" Ennius gasped. "You're lying, Sparhawk!"
"You can verify it for yourself, Ennius. When I take you back to Kyrelos, I'm sure you'll have plenty of time to examine the records of the meeting. There's quite a dispute in the works about who's going to have the pleasure of putting you on trial and executing you. It may drag on for years. Somehow you've managed to offend just about everybody west of the Zemok border. They all want to kill you for some reason." "You're being just a bit childish, Sparhawk," Martell sneered. "Of course I am. We all do that sometimes. It's really a shame the sunset was so uninspiring this evening, Martell, since it was the last one you're ever going to see." "That's true of one of us, at any rate."
"Euphrania."
It was rumbling, deep-toned gurgle more than a voice.
"Yes, Ulfa," she replied calmly.
"Bid thy witless little goddess farewell,"
the slug-like man on the throne rumbled in antique Aline. His little eyes were focused now, though his hands still trembled.
"Thine unnatural kinship with the younger gods draws to its close. Azash awaits thee."
"I rather doubt that, Otha, for I bring the Unknown One with me. I found him long before he was born, and I have brought him here with Beliom in his fist." "Azash fears him, Otha, and you would be wise to fear him too."
Otha sank lower on his throne, his head seeming to retract turtle-like into the folds of his fat neck. His hand moved with surprising speed, and a beam of greenish light shot from it, a light leveled at the small Styric woman. Sparhawk, however, had been waiting for that. He had been holding his shield in both bare hands in a negligent appearing posture. The blood-red stones of the rings were quite firmly pressed against the shield's steel rim. With practiced speed, he thrust the shield in front of his tutor. The beam of green light struck the shield and reflected back from its polished surface. One of the armored guards was suddenly obliterated in a soundless blast that sprayed the throne room with white-hot fragments of his chainmail. Sparhawk drew his sword. "Have we just about finished with all this nonsense, Martell?" he asked bleakly.
"Wish I could oblige, old boy," Martell replied. "But Azash is waiting for us. You know how that goes."
The hammering on the heavy door Tinian and Euleth were guarding grew louder.
"Is that someone knocking?" Martell said mildly. "Be a good fellow, Sparhawk, and see who it is. All that banging sets my teeth on edge."
Sparhawk started forward.
"Take the Emperor to safety,"
Ennius barked to the barely clad brutes squatting near the throne. With practiced haste, the men inserted stout steel poles into recesses in the jeweled seat, set their shoulders under the poles, and lifted the vast weight of their master from the pedestal-like base of the throne. Then they wheeled with the litter and trotted ponderously toward the arched opening behind the throne.
"Addis,"
Martell commanded.
"Keep them off me."
Then he too turned and herded Ennius and his family along in Otha's wake as the brutish Addis pushed forward, flogging at Otha's spear-armed guards with the flat of his sword and bellowing unintelligible orders. The hammering at the locked doors became a booming sound as the soldiers outside improvised battering rams.
"Sparhawk," Tinian shouted, "those doors won't hold for long."
"Leave them," Sparhawk shouted back. "Help us here! Otha and Martell are getting away!" The soldiers Addis commanded had spread out to face Sparhawk, Curic, and Bavior, not so much to engage them as to prevent their entering the arched doorway that led back into the labyrinth. Although he was in most respects profoundly, even frighteningly stupid, Addis was a gifted warrior,
and a fight of this nature, involving as it did a simple situation and a manageable number of men, put him in his natural element. He directed Otha's guardsmen with grunts, kicks, and blows, deploying them in pairs and trios to block individual opponents with their spears. The concept implicit in Martell's command was well within Ada's limited grasp. His purpose was to delay the knights long enough to enable Martell to escape, and perhaps no one was better suited for that than Adas. As Kaltan, Ulith, Tinian, and Beirut joined the fight, Adas gave ground. He had the advantage of numbers, but his Zamok soldiers were no match for the steel-clad knights. He was, however, able to pull the bulk of his force back into the mouth of the maze, where their spears could serve as an effective barrier. And all the while, the rhythmic booming of the battering rams continued. "We've got to get into that maze," Tinian shouted. "When those doors give way, we're going to be surrounded." It was Sir Bavier who took action. The young Cyrenic knight was bravery personified, and on many occasions he had demonstrated a total disregard for his own personal safety. He strode forward, swinging his brutal, hook-pointed Lochaber axe. He swung not at the soldiers, but at their spears. And a spear without a point is nothing more than a pole. Within moments he had effectively disarmed Adas Zamox, and had received a deep wound in his side just above the hip. He fell back weakly, with blood streaming from the rent in his armor. "See to him!" Sparhawk barked to Beirut, and lunged forward to engage the Zamox. Without their spears, the Zamox were forced to fall back on their swords, and the advantage shifted to the church knights at that point. The armored men chopped the Zamox out of their path. Adas assessed the situation quickly and stepped back into the doorway. "Adas!" Kaltan bellowed, kicking a Zamok out of his way.
"Kaltan!"
Adas roared. The brute took a step forward, his pig-like eyes hungry. Then he snarled and disemboweled one of his own soldiers to give vent to his frustration, and disappeared back into the maze. Sparhawk whirled about. "How is he?" he demanded of Sophrenia, who knelt over the wounded Bavier.
"It's serious, Sparhawk."
"Can you stop the bleeding?"
"Not entirely, no."
Bavier lay pale and sweating, with the breastplate of his armor unbuckled and lying open like a clamshell.
"Go on, Sparhawk," he said. "I'll hold this doorway for as long as I can."
"Don't be stupid," Sparhawk snapped. "Pad the wound as best you can, Sophrenia. Then buckle his armor back up. Beirut, bring him along. Carry him if you have to." There was a splintering sound behind them in the throne room as the booming continued.
"The doors are giving way, Sparhawk," Kaltan reported.
Sparhawk looked down the long arched corridor leading into the maze. Torches were set in iron rings at widely spaced intervals. A sudden hope flared up in him.
"Ulith," he said, "you and Tinian bring up the rear. Shout if any of those soldiers breaking down the doors come up behind us."
"I'll just hold you back, Sparhawk," Bavier said weakly.
"No, you won't," Sparhawk replied. "We're not going to run through this maze. We don't know what's in here, so we're not going to take any chances." "All right, gentlemen, let's move out."
They started down the long, straight corridor that led into the labyrinth, passing two or three unlighted entrances on either side as they went.
"Shouldn't we check those?" Kaltan asked.
"It's probably not necessary," Kurek said. "Some of Adas' men were wounded, and there are blood spatters on the floor. We know that Adas at least went this way."
"That's no guarantee that Martell did," Kaltan said. "Maybe he told Adas to lead us off in the wrong direction."
"It's possible," Sparhawk conceded. "But this corridor is lighted, and none of the others are."
"I'd hardly call it a maze if the way through it is marked with torches, Sparhawk," Kurek pointed out.
"Maybe not. But as long as the torches and the blood trail go the same way, we'll chance it." The echoing corridor made a sharp turn to the left at its far end. The vaulted walls and ceiling curving upward and inward gave the twisting passages that oppressive sense of being too low, and Sparhawk found himself instinctively ducking his head.
"They've broken through the doors in the throne room, Sparhawk," Ulith called from the rear. "There are some torches bobbing around back in the entryway."
"That more or less settles it," Sparhawk said. "We don't have time to start exploring side passages. Let's go on." The lighted corridor began to twist and turn at that point, and the spots of blood on the floor suggested that they were still on the same trail Adas had followed. The corridor turned to the right.
"How are you bearing up?" Sparhawk asked Bavier, who was leaning heavily on Beirut's shoulder.
Fine, Sparhawk. As soon as I get my breath, I'll be able to make it without help.
The corridor turned to the left again, then to the left again after only a few yards.
We're going back the same way we came, Sparhawk, Keurig declared.
I know. Do we have any choice, though?
Not that I can think of, no.
Euleth, Sparhawk called. Are the men behind us gaining at all?
Not that I can see.
Maybe they don't know the way through the maze either, Colton suggested. I don't think anyone would visit Azash just for fun. The rush came out of a side corridor. 5 spear-armed Zamok soldiers dashed out of the dark entryway and bore down on Sparhawk, Colton, and Keurig. Their spears gave them some advantage, but not enough. After 3 of their number had been felled to lie writhing and bleeding on the flagstone floor, the other 2 fled back the way they had come. Keurig seized a torch from one of the iron rings in the wall and led Sparhawk and Colton into the dark, twisting corridor. After several minutes, they saw the soldiers they were pursuing. The 2 men were fearfully edging their way through a stretch of the passage, each one of them hugging a wall.
Now we've got them! Colton exulted, starting forward.
Colton! Keurig's voice cracked.
Stop!
What's wrong?
They're staying too close to the walls.
So?
What's wrong with the middle of the passageway?
Colton stared at the 2 frightened men clinging to the walls, his eyes narrowing.
Let's find out, he said.
He pried up a small flagstone with his sword point and hurled it at one of the soldiers, missing his mark by several feet.
Let me do it, Keurig told him. You can't throw anything with your armor binding up your shoulders the way it does.
He pried loose another stone. His aim was much more true. The rock he had thrown bounced off the soldier's helmet with a loud clang. The man cried out as he reeled back, trying desperately to grab some kind of handhold on the stone wall. He failed, however, and stepped onto the floor in the center of the corridor. The floor promptly fell open under him, and he dropped from sight with a despairing shriek. His companion, straining to see, also made a misstep, and fell from the narrow ledge along the wall to follow his friend into the pit.
Clever, Keurig said.
He advanced to the brink of the gaping pit and raised his torch. The bottom studded with sharpened stakes, he observed, looking down at the 2 men impaled below. Let's go back and tell the others. I think we'd better start watching where we put our feet. They returned to that torch-lit main corridor as Euleth and Tinian joined them from the rear. Keurig tersely described the trap that had claimed the 2 Zamoks. He looked thoughtfully at the soldiers who had fallen here in the corridor and picked up one of their spears.
These weren't Addis men.
How do you know that? Colton asked him.
Sir Bavior broke the spears of the ones who were with Addis.
That means there are other soldiers here in the labyrinth, probably in small groups the same as this one.
I'd guess that they're here to lead us into traps in the side corridors.
That's very obliging of them, Euleth said.
I don't follow your reasoning, Sir Euleth.
There are traps in the maze, but we have soldiers around to spring them for us. All we have to do is catch them.
One of those silver linings people talk about, Tinian asked.
You could say that, yes. The Zamoks we catch might not look at it that way, though.
Are those soldiers behind us coming up very fast? Keurig asked him.
Not very.
Keurig went back to the side corridor, holding his torch aloft. He was smiling grimly when he came back.
There are torch rings in the side passages, the same as there are in this one, he told them.
Why don't we move a few torches as we go along? We've been following the torches, and those soldiers have been following us. If the torches start leading them off into the side passages, where the traps are, wouldn't they sort of slow down a bit?
I don't know about them, Euleth said, but I know I would.
Chapter 28 Zamok's soldiers periodically charged out of side corridors, their faces bearing the hopeless expressions of men who considered themselves already dead. The ultimatum, surrender or die, however, opened an option to them the existence of which they had not even been aware. Most of them leaped at the chance to seize it. Their effusive gratitude waned, however, when they found that they were expected to take the lead. The traps designed to surprise the unwary were ingenious. In those passages where the floor did not drop open, the ceiling collapsed.
The bottoms of most of the pits in the floor were studded with sharpened stakes, although several pits housed assorted reptiles, all venomous and all bad-tempered. Once, when the designer of the labyrinth had evidently grown bored with pits and falling ceilings, the walls smashed forcefully together.
"There's something wrong here," Keurig said, even as yet another despairing shriek echoed through the maze from behind them, where the soldiers who had burst into the throne room were exploring side corridors.
"Things seem to be going rather well to me," Calton said.
"These soldiers live here, Calton," the squire said, "and they don't seem to be any more familiar with this labyrinth than we are. We've just run out of prisoners again. I think it's time to consider a few things. Let's not make any blunders."
They gathered in the center of the corridor.
"This doesn't make any sense, you know," Keurig told them.
"Coming to Zamok?" Calton said. "I could have told you that back in Kyrolos."
Keurig ignored that.
"We've been following a trail of blood spots on the floor, and that trail is still stretching on out in front of us, right down the middle of a torchlit corridor." He scraped one foot at a large blood spot on the floor. "If someone were really bleeding this hard, he would have been dead a long time ago."
Talon bent, touched one finger to a glistening red spot on the floor, and then touched the finger to his tongue. He spat.
"It isn't blood," he said.
"What is it?" Calton asked.
"I don't know, but it isn't blood."
"We've been bamboozled, then," Ulith said sourly. "I was beginning to wonder about that. What's worse, we're trapped in here. We can't even turn around and follow the torches back because we've been busily moving torches for the past half hour or more."
"This is what's known in logic as defining the problem," Bavia said with a weak smile. "I think the next step is called finding a solution."
"I'm no expert at it," Calton admitted, "but I don't think we're going to be able to logic our way out of this."
"Why not use the rings?" Bayret suggested. "Couldn't Sparhawk just blow a hole right straight through the maze?"
"The passages are mostly barrel vaults, Bayret," Keurig said. "If we start blowing holes in the walls, we'll have the ceiling down on our heads."
"What a shame," Calton sighed.
"So many good ideas have to be discarded simply because they won't work."
"Are we absolutely bent on solving the riddle of the maze?" Talon asked them. "I mean, does finding the solution have some sort of religious significance?"
"None that I know of," Tinian replied.
"Why stay inside the maze, then?" the boy asked innocently.
"Because we're trapped here," Sparhawk told him, trying to control his irritation.
"That's not exactly true, Sparhawk. We've never been really trapped. Keurig might be right about the danger involved in knocking down the walls, but he didn't say a thing about the ceiling."
They stared at him. Then they all began to laugh a bit foolishly.
"We don't know what's up there, of course," Ulith noted.
"We don't know what's around the next corner either, Sir Knight. And we'll never know what's above the ceiling until we have a look, will we?"
"It could just be open sky," Keurig said.
"Is that any worse than what we have down here, Father? Once we get outside, Sparhawk might be able to use the rings to break through the outer wall of the temple. Otha may find mazes entertaining, but I think I've more or less gotten enough amusement out of this one. One of the first rules Platymy ever taught me was that if you don't like the game, don't play."
Sparhawk looked questioningly at Sophrenia. She was also smiling ruefully.
"I didn't even think of it myself," she admitted.
"Can we do it?"
"I don't see any reason why not, as long as we stand back a ways so that we don't get crushed by falling rubble. Let's have a look at this ceiling."
They raised their torches to look up at the barrel-vaulted ceiling.
"Is that construction going to cause any kind of problem?" Sparhawk asked Keurig.
"Not really. The stones are laid in interlocking courses, so they'll hold, eventually. There's going to be a lot of rubble, though."
"That's all right, Keurig," Talon said gaily. "The rubble will give us something to climb up on."
"It's going to take a great deal of force to knock loose any of those stone blocks, though," Keurig said. "The weight of the whole corridor is holding the vault together."
"What would happen if a few of those blocks just weren't there anymore?" Sophrenia asked him.
Keurig went to one of the upward-curving walls and probed at a crack between two stone blocks with his knife.
"They used mortar," he said. "It's fairly rotten, though. If you can dissolve a half dozen of those blocks up there, a fairly sizable piece of the ceiling will fall in."
"But the whole corridor won't collapse?"
He shook his head.
No. After a few yards of it tumble in, the structure will be sound again.
Can you really dissolve rocks? Tinian asked Sophrenia curiously. She smiled. No, dear one. But I can change them into sand, which amounts to the same thing, doesn't it?
She intently studied the ceiling for several moments.
Euleth, she said then, you're the tallest. Lift me up. I have to touch the stones.
Euleth blushed a bright red, and they all knew why. Sophrenia was not the sort of person one put his hands on.
Oh, don't be such a goose, Euleth, she told him. Lift me up.
Euleth looked around menacingly.
We aren't going to talk about this, are we?
He said to his friends. Then he bent and lifted her easily.
She clambered upward, looking not unlike someone climbing a tree.
When she was high enough, she reached up and put the palms of her hands on several of the stones, pausing briefly with each one. Her touch seemed almost caressing.
That should do it, she said. You can put me down again, Sir Knight.
Euleth lowered her to the floor, and they retreated back down the corridor.
Be ready to run, she cautioned them. This is a little inexact.
She began to move her hands in front of her, speaking rapidly in Styric as she did so. Then she held out both hands, palms up, to release the spell. Fine sand began to sift down from the ceiling, slithering out of the cracks between the roughly squared-off building blocks. At first it was only a trickle, but it steadily increased.
Looks almost like water leaking out, doesn't it? Colton observed as the sand flow increased.
The walls began to creak, and there were popping noises as the mortar between the stones started to crack.
We can go back a bit farther, Sophrenia said, looking apprehensively at all the rock around them. The spell's working. We don't have to stand here to supervise it.
Sophrenia was a very complex little woman. She was sometimes timid about very ordinary things, and at other times indifferent to horrendous ones. They walked farther on back up the corridor as the building blocks near the place where the sand was now pouring down out of the ceiling creaked and groaned and grated together, settling in a fraction of an inch at a time to replace the sand. When it came all at once. A large section of the overhead vault collapsed with the grinding clatter of falling rock, and a large cloud of eons-old dust that billowed down the corridor toward them, setting them all to coughing. As the dust gradually settled, they saw a large, jagged hole in the ceiling.
"Let's go have a look," Talon said. "I'm curious to find out what's up there."
"Could we wait just a bit longer?" Sophrenia asked fearfully.
"I'd really like to be sure that it's safe."
They struggled up the pile of rubble from the fallen ceiling and boosted each other up through the hole. The area above the ceiling was a vast, domed emptiness, dusty and stale-smelling. The light from the torches they had brought with them from the corridor below seemed sickly and did not reach out as far as the walls, if walls to this dim place indeed existed. The floor resembled to a remarkable degree a field laced with the upward bulging burrows of a colony of extraordinarily industrious moles, and they saw a number of structural peculiarities they had not perceived when down in the maze.
"Sliding walls," Curic said, pointing. "They can change the maze any time they want to by closing off some passages and opening others. That's why those Zamok soldiers didn't know where they were going." "There's a light," Euleth told them, "way over there to the left. It seems to be coming up from down below.
The temple, maybe?" Colton suggested.
"Or the throne room again. Let's go have a look."
They threaded their way along the tops of the vaults for some distance, and then came to a straight path that stretched in one direction toward the light Euleth had seen, and off into the darkness in the other.
"No dust," Euleth said, pointing at the stones of the path. "This is used fairly often."
The going was much faster on the straight pathway, and they soon reached the source of the flickering light. It was a flight of stone stairs leading down into a torchlit room, a room with four walls and no doors.
"That's ridiculous," Colton snorted.
"Not really," Curic disagreed, raising his torch to peer over the side of the path.
"That front wall slides on those tracks."
He pointed at a pair of metal tracks below that emerged from the room on the outside. He leaned forward to look more closely.
"There's no machinery out here, so there has to be a latch of some kind in that room.
Sparhawk, let's go down and see if we can find it. The two of them went down the stairs into the room. What are we looking for? Sparhawk asked his friend. How should I know? Something that looks ordinary but isn't. That's not very specific, Curic.
Just start pushing on rocks, Sparhawk. If you find one that can be depressed, it's probably the latch.
They went along the walls, pushing on rocks. After a few minutes, Curic stopped, a slightly foolish look on his face.
You can stop, Sparhawk, he said. I found the latches.
Where?
There are torches on the side walls and on the back, right?
Yes. So what?
But there aren't any torches on the front wall, the one right in front of the foot of the stairs.
So?
There are a couple of torch rings, though.
Curic went to the front wall and pulled on one of the rusty iron rings. There was a solid-sounding clank.
Pull the other one, Sparhawk, he suggested. Let's open this door and see what's behind it.
Sometimes you're so clever you make me sick, Curic, Sparhawk said sourly. Then he grinned.
Let's get the others down here first, he said. I'd rather not open that door and find half the Zamok army behind it with only the two of us here to hold them off.
He went to the stairs and beckoned to his waiting friends, touching one finger to his lips as he did so to signal the need for silence. They came down quietly to avoid clinking.
Curic found the latches, Sparhawk whispered. We don't know what's on the other side of the door, so we'd better be ready.
Curic motioned to them.
The wall isn't too heavy, he said quietly, and the track it slides on seems to be well greased. Bayret and I should be able to move it. The rest of you should be ready for anything on the other side.
Talon moved quickly to the corner on the left side and put his face close to the two intersecting walls.
I'll be able to look through here just as soon as you get it open an inch or so, he told his father. If I shout, slam it shut again.
Curic nodded.
Are we ready? He asked.
They all nodded, their weapons in their hands and their muscles tense. Curic and Bayret pulled out on the torch rings and inched the wall aside slightly.
Anything yet?
Curic hissed to his son.
Nobody's there, Talon replied. It's a short corridor with just one torch. It seems to go back about 20 paces and then it turns to the left. There's quite a bit of light coming from beyond that turn.
All right, Bayret, Curic said. Let's open it all the way.
The two of them slid the wall the rest of the way open.
Now that is very, very clever, Bavier said admiringly. The labyrinth down here doesn't go anywhere at all. The real route to the temple is up above it.
Let's find out where we are. In the temple or back at the throne room, Sparhawk said. And let's be as quiet as we can. Talon looked as if he were about to say something.
Forget it, Curic told him. It's too dangerous. You just stay behind the rest of us with Sophronia.
They moved out into the short corridor, where the single torch near the far end provided a dim, flickering light.
I don't hear anything, Calton whispered to Sparhawk.
People waiting in ambush don't usually make noise, Calton. They paused just before the corridor turned sharply to the left. Euleth edged to the corner, pulled off his helmet and took a quick look, his head darting out and back once.
Empty, he said shortly. It seems to turn right about 10 or 15 paces farther on.
They moved on around the corner and crept along the short passage. Again they stopped at the corner, and Euleth popped his head out again.
It's a kind of an alcove, he whispered. There's an archway that opens out into a wider corridor. There's a lot of light out there.
Did you see anybody? Curic asked him.
Not a soul.
That should be the main corridor out there, Bavier murmured. The stairs that lead up out of the maze to the real route to the temple should be fairly close to the end of the labyrinth, either at the throne room or at the temple.
They rounded the corner into the alcove, and Euleth again took a quick look.
It's a main corridor, all right, he reported, and there's a turn 100 paces off to the left.
Let's go up to that corner, Sparhawk decided. If Bavier's right, the hallway beyond the corner should lead out of the maze. Sophronia, you stay in here with Talon, Bavier, and Bayret.
Curic, you guard the door. The rest of us will go have a look.
He leaned close to his squire and whispered, If things start to go wrong, get Sophronia and the others back to the room at the foot of the stairs.
Slide the wall shut and lock it.
Curic nodded. Be careful out there, Sparhawk, he said quietly.
You too, my friend. The four knights stepped out into the broad vaulted corridor and crept along toward the torchlit corner ahead. Carlton followed the rest of them, turning often to keep watch to the rear. At the corner, Euleth briefly poked out his head. Then he stepped back.
We might have known, he whispered disgustedly. It's the throne room. We're right back where we started from.
Is there anybody in there? Tinian asked.
Probably, but why bother them? Let's just go on back to that staircase, slide the wall shut again, and leave the people in the throne room to take care of their own entertainment.
It was as they were turning around that it happened. Adas, followed by a score of Zamok soldiers, burst from a side passage not too far from the entrance to the alcove, and he was bellowing at the top of his lungs. Cries of alarm echoed into the corridor from the throne room itself.
Tinian, Euleth, Sparhawk snapped. Hold off the ones in the throne room.
Let's go, Carlton. Then he and his blonde friend dashed back toward the opening where Curic stood guard. Adas was far too limited to be anything but predictable. He savagely drove his soldiers on ahead of him and slouched forward, a brutal war axe in his hand and an insane look in his pig-like eyes. It was too far. Sparhawk saw that immediately. Adas was much closer to the arched entrance to the alcove than he and Carlton were, and there were already soldiers between him and his friend and the archway. He chopped a Zamok out of his way.
Curic! He shouted. Fall back!
But it was too late. Curic had already engaged the ape-like Adas. His chain mace whistled through the air, crunching into his opponent's armored shoulders and chest. But Adas was in the grip of a killing frenzy, and he ignored those dreadful blows. Again and again he smashed at Curic's shield with his war axe. Curic was undoubtedly one of the most skilled men in the world when close fighting was involved, but Adas appeared totally mad. He hacked and kicked and bulled his way at Curic, pushing and flailing with his battle axe. Curic was forced to retreat, giving ground grudgingly step by step. Then, Adas threw his shield aside, took his axe handle in both hands, and began to swing a rapid series of blows at Curic's head. Forced finally into one last defense, Curic grasped his shield with both hands and raised it to protect his head from those massive blows. Roaring in triumph, Adas swung not at Curic's head, but at his body. The brutal axe bit deep into the side of his chest, and blood gushed from his mouth and from the dreadful wound in his chest.
Sparhawk!
He cried weakly, falling back against the side of the arch. Adas raised his axe again.
Adas!
Carlton roared, killing another Zamok. Adas checked the axe blow he had aimed at Curic's unprotected head and half turned.
Carlton!
He bellowed back his challenge. He contemptuously kicked Sparhawk's friend out of his way and shambled toward the blonde Pandion, his piggish eyes burning insanely beneath his shaggy brows. Sparhawk and Carlton abandoned any semblance of swordsmanship and simply cut down anything in their paths, relying more on strength and fury than on skill. Adas, totally insane now, also chopped his way through his own soldiers to reach them. Curic stumbled out into the corridor, clutching at his bleeding chest and trying to shake out his chain mace, but his legs faltered. He stumbled and fell. With enormous effort, he rose to his elbows and began to drag himself after the savage who had struck him down. Then his eyes went blank and he fell onto his face.
Curic!
Sparhawk howled. The light seemed to fade from his eyes, and there was a deafening ringing in his ears. His sword suddenly appeared to have no weight. He cut down whatever appeared before him. At one point he found himself chopping at the stones of the wall. It was the sparks, somehow, that returned him to his senses. Curic would take him to task for damaging his sword edge. Somehow, Talon had reached his father's side. He knelt, struggling to turn Curic over. And then he wailed, a cry of unspeakable loss.
He's dead, Sparhawk! My father's dead!
The wrench of that cry nearly drove Sparhawk to his knees. He shook his head like some dumb animal. He hadn't heard that cry. He could not have heard it. He absently killed another Zamok.
Dimly he heard the sound of fighting behind him, and he knew that Tinian and Uleth were engaging the soldiers from the throne room. Then Talon rose, sobbing and reaching down into his boot. His long, needle-pointed dirk came out gleaming in his fist, and he advanced on Adas from the rear, his soft-shod feet making no sound. Tears streamed down the boy's face, but his teeth were clenched with hate. Sparhawk ran his sword through another Zamok, even as Kaltan sent another head rolling down the corridor. Adas brained one of his own soldiers, roaring like an enraged bull. The roar suddenly broke off. Adas gaped, his eyes bulging. His mismatched armor did not fit very well, and the back of his cuirass did not reach all the way to his hips. It was there, in that area covered only by chainmail, that Talon had stabbed him. Chainmail will ward off the blow of sword or axe, but it is no defense against a thrust. Talon's dirk drove smoothly into the half-witted brute's back, just under the lower rim of the cuirass, seeking and finding Adas' kidney. Talon jerked his dirk free and stabbed again on the other side this time. Adas squealed like a stuck pig in a slaughterhouse. He stumbled forward, one hand clutching at the small of his back, his face suddenly dead white with pain and shock. Talon drove his dirk into the back of the animal's knee. Adas stumbled a few more steps, dropping his axe and grabbing at his back with both hands. Then he fell writhing to the floor. Sparhawk and Kaltan cut down the remaining Zamok soldiers, but Talon had already snatched up a fallen sword, and standing astride Adas' body was chopping at the brute's helmeted head. Then he reversed the sword and tried desperately to stab down through the breastplate into Adas' writhing body, but he did not have enough strength to make his weapon penetrate. "Help me!" he cried. "Somebody help me!" Sparhawk stepped to the weeping boy's side, his own eyes also streaming tears. He dropped his sword and reached out to take the hilt of the one that Talon was trying to drive into Adas. Then he took hold of the sword's crosspiece with his other hand. "You do it like this, Talon," he said almost clinically, as if he were merely giving instructions on the practice field. Then, standing one on either side of the whimpering Adas, the boy and the man took hold of the sword, their hands touching on the hilt. "We don't have to hurry, Sparhawk," Talon grated from between clenched teeth. "No," Sparhawk agreed. "Not really, if you don't want to." Adas shrieked as they slowly pushed the sword into him. The shriek broke off as a great fountain of blood gushed from his mouth.
"Please,"
he gurgled. Sparhawk and Talon grimly twisted the sword. Adas shrieked again, banging his head on the floor and beating a rapid tattoo on the flagstones with his heels. He arched his quivering body, belched forth another gusher of blood, and collapsed in an inert heap. Talon, weeping, sprawled across the body, clawing at the dead man's staring eyes. Then Sparhawk bent, gently picked the boy up, and carried him back to where Kyurik lay. Chapter 29 There was still fighting in the torchlit corridor, the clash of steel on steel, cries, shouts, and groans. Sparhawk knew that he must go to the aid of his friends, but the enormity of what had just happened left him stunned, unable to move. Talon knelt beside Kyurik's lifeless body, weeping and pounding his fist on the flagstone floor. "I have to go," the big Pandion told the boy. Talon did not answer. "Beirut!" Sparhawk called. "Come here." The young apprentice came cautiously out of the alcove, his axe in his hands. "Help Talon," Sparhawk said. "Take Kyurik back inside." Beirut was staring in disbelief at Kyurik. "Move, boy," Sparhawk said sharply, "and take care of Sophronia."
"Sparhawk," Kaltan shouted. "There are more of them coming."
"On the way." Sparhawk looked at Talon. "I have to go," he told the boy again.
"Go ahead,"
Talon replied. Then he looked up, his tear-streaked face savage. "Kill them all, Sparhawk," he said fiercely.
"Kill them all!"
Sparhawk nodded. That would help Talon a bit, he thought, as he returned to retrieve his sword. Anger was a good remedy for grief. He picked up his sword and turned, feeling his own rage burning in his throat. He almost pitied the Zamok soldiers as he went to rejoin Kalton. "Fall back," he told his friend in a coldly level tone. "Get your breath."
"Is there any hope?"
Kalton asked, parrying a Zamok spear thrust. "No."
"I'm sorry, Sparhawk."
It was a small group of soldiers, no doubt one of the detachments that had been trying to lure the knights into side passages. Sparhawk went toward them purposefully. It was good to be fighting. Fighting demanded every bit of a man's attention and pushed everything else from his mind. Sparhawk moved deftly against the half-dozen Zamoks. There was a certain obscure justice working now. Kurik had taught him every move, every technical nuance he was bringing to bear, and those skills were supplemented by a towering rage over his friend's death. In a very real sense, Kurik had made Sparhawk invincible. Even Kalton seemed shocked at his friend's sheer savagery. It was the work of no more than a few moments to kill five of the soldiers facing him. The last turned to flee, but Sparhawk passed his sword quickly to his shield hand, bent and picked up a Zamok spear. "Take this with you," he called after the fleeing man. Then he made a long, practiced cast. The spear took the soldier squarely between the shoulder blades.
"Good throw," Kalton said. "Let's go help Tinian and Uleth."
Sparhawk still felt a powerful need to kill people. He led his friend back toward the turn in the corridor where the Alcyone knight and his Genidian comrade were holding back the soldiers who had rushed into the maze from the throne room in response to Adis' bellowed command.
"I'll take care of this," Sparhawk said flatly.
"Kurik?" Uleth asked. Sparhawk shook his head and began killing Zamoks again. He waded on, leaving the maimed behind him for his companions to dispatch.
"Sparhawk!" Uleth shouted. "Stop! They're running!"
"Hurry!" Sparhawk yelled back.
"We can still catch them!"
"Let them go!"
"No!"
"You're keeping Martell waiting, Sparhawk," Kalton said sharply. Kalton sometimes made a show of being stupid, but Sparhawk saw immediately just how smoothly his blonde friend had brought him up short. Killing relatively innocent soldiers was no more than an idle pastime when compared to dealing once and for all with the white-haired renegade. He stopped.
"All right," he panted, nearly exhausted from his exertions.
"Let's go back. We've got to get past that sliding wall before the soldiers come back anyway."
"Are you feeling any better?" Tinian asked as they started back toward the alcove.
"Not really," Sparhawk said. They passed Adis' body.
"Go on ahead," Kalton told them. "I'll be right along."
Beirut and Bavier awaited them at the entrance to the alcove.
"Did you chase them off?"
Bavier asked.
"Sparhawk did," Uleth grunted. "He was very convincing."
"Aren't they likely to gather reinforcements and come back?"
"Not unless their officers have very large whips, they won't."
Sophronia had arranged Kurik's body in a posture of repose. His cloak covered the dreadful wound that had spilled out his life. His eyes were closed, and his face calm. Once again, Sparhawk felt an unbearable grief.
"Is there any way—" he began, even though he already knew the answer.
Sophronia shook her head. "No, dear one," she replied. "I'm sorry." She sat beside the body, holding the weeping Talon in her arms. Sparhawk sighed.
"We're going to have to leave," he told them. "We have to get back to those stairs before anybody decides to follow us."
He looked back over his shoulder. Kalton was hurrying to join them, and he was carrying something wrapped in a Zamok cloak.
"I'll do this," Uleth said.
He bent and picked Kurik up as if the powerful squire were no more than a child, and they retraced their steps to the foot of the stairs leading up into the dusty darkness above. End of Side 11. To continue, turn the cassette over.